KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Welcome to The Menu on Native America Calling, our special feature on Indigenous food. I'm Andy Murphy. In the new Canadian food show, One Dish, One Spoon, Mohawk sisters Tanya and Dakota Brandt take their viewers on a culinary tour of their Six Nations Reserve. Zach Ducheneau was the first Native American administrator of the USDA's Farm Service Agency. He reflects on his time with the federal office and what's next. And Mariah Gladstone, creator of IndigiKitchen, has a new cookbook called Mountains to Oceans that caters specifically to children. We're back after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The issue of missing and murdered Indigenous people continues to be of national concern among tribes. Now, tribes are hoping new measures will get bipartisan support in Congress to help tribal law enforcement solve these cases. The bills also coincide with the first ever Missing in Nevada Day this weekend. The Mountain West News Bureau's Yvette Fernandez has the details.
One bill is called Badges, Bridging Agency Data Gaps and Ensuring Safety. The other is called Invest to Protect. Both would fund tribal law enforcement to combat violence and, in particular, address the missing and murdered Indigenous people crisis. Tribal chairman of the Las Vegas Paiute tribe, Benny So, says these funds would give them access to forensic resources and enhance data sharing among tribal and non-tribal law enforcement. He says it will impact their ability to solve these crimes.
A lot of our brothers and sisters go missing to no avail with no help or no resources. And it seems like a lot of those cases get swept under the rug, and it's troubling to hear, you know, all of these cases that go unheard or unanswered.
According to the National Crime Information Center, murder is the third leading cause of death for Indigenous women and is 10 times higher than all other ethnicities. Both measures passed the U.S. Senate last year, but will have to be reintroduced with the current Congress. I'm Yvette Fernandez.
A nearly 1,000-year-old cache linked to the Dene people was found near Cook Inlet this summer. Researchers say it's the oldest such find in the Anchorage Bowl. KMBA's Alaska Desk reporter Alona Niden has more.
Archaeologists discovered a cellar lined with birch bark in June at a known Dene site at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. They estimate that the cache was about 3.5 feet across and was likely used for storing food. Aaron Leggett is the president of the native village of Aklutna, located roughly 20 miles north of the discovery. He says it's another testament that the Dene people have been the stewards of the lands in south central Alaska for at least a millennia.
It's further confirmation of Dene oral tradition. It also shows that there's still a lot more work to be done on Dene archaeology, and especially in Upper Cook Inlet.
Jaybird archaeologist Lise Ortiz was among those who first encountered the cache. Ortiz says that she and her colleague expected it to be a couple hundred years old. Instead, tests showed something extraordinary for South Central Alaska, a relatively densely populated region where ground conditions are less stable compared to other parts of the state.
When we got the results back that said it was 960 years plus or minus 30, we were shocked. I mean, Morgan and I were jumping up and down in our cube and tears. It was very, very exciting.
Another Jaybird archaeologist, Morgan Grover, says that discoveries like these are important to discuss.
Anchorage is a new town. You know, 1914 is when it's first established, but there are people who were here much longer than that.
Researchers collaborated with elders and knowledge holders from the Dena'ina and Atna tribes to get more context about the place. Today, half of Alaska's population lives within the Dene homelands, and like it says, careful analysis of the remaining sites in consultation with the tribes is crucial.
We know we can't stop development, but can we use these opportunities to kind of fill in the picture?
Archaeologists plan to further evaluate the soil samples in and around the cache. Together with tribal leaders, they hope to go back to the site later this year. In Anchorage, I'm Alona Niden.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
DT Track, your healthcare partner, provides access to a nationwide network of qualified healthcare temporary staff, including medical billing professionals that optimize your revenue cycles. More at dt-track.com who support this show. Educators, ready to transform Indigenous education? The NISN School Design Fellowship is accepting community letters of interest through January 31st at NACAInspiredSchoolsNetwork.org who support this show. Support provided by First National Bank Alaska, offering a one-solution, tailored approach to meet the financial needs of Alaskans by providing banking services, loans, investments, and more to help shape a brighter tomorrow. Learn more at fnbalaska.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is the menu on Native America Calling, our special feature on Indigenous food. I'm Andy Murphy. Witnessing the farm crisis in the 80s helped Zach Ducheneau understand federal farm funding and how things could be better and easier. In 2021, the third-generation Lakota rancher got the chance to do just that when he took on the role of USDA Farm Service Agency Administrator, overseeing the federal agency responsible for farm and ag finances. He left his post this month and has time to talk about his work at the federal level and the challenges ahead. Later in the hour, we'll talk with Mariah Gladstone of IndigiKitchen about her brand new cookbook called Mountains to Oceans, Kids Recipes from Native Land. But first, One Dish, One Spoon is a new APTN TV series by Mohawk chef Tanya Brandt. It exposes traditional food of the Six Nations in Ontario and introduces viewers to Indigenous people who are doing some great food sovereignty work there. You can join us, too, with your comments for our guests. We're at 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us from Six Nations in Ontario, Canada, is Tanya Brandt. She's a Mohawk Nation chef from Six Nations, and she is the host of the APTN show One Dish, One Spoon. Welcome to the menu, Tanya.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So the phrase one dish, one spoon has a special meaning for First Nations. Can you explain that title for us and why you chose that?
The reason we chose one dish, one spoon goes back to the dish with one spoon wampum, which was agreement among nations. They say up to 50 nations in the Great Beaver Basin area, which is right where we're located in Southern Ontario. And when we got the funding and stuff to do the show, we filmed it about 3 years ago, so it was during COVID, right? So we couldn't really go anywhere, didn't really have the funds to do it anyways as a pilot season and stuff. So we just went to local, like, we realized we have so much rich history here and amazing people doing incredible work, so we just wanted to focus on highlighting that and deliver something to APTN that they would really like and get green lit for a second season.
All right. And APTN is pretty far ahead from what we have here in the States. They have a couple of shows focusing on Indigenous food there. How does One Dish, One Spoon sort of distinguish itself from other cooking shows, especially from cooking shows that are not specifically Native or Indigenous centered?
I think it's kind of a bit of a cookie cutter out there right now when it comes to Indigenous cooking shows, where you have an Indigenous or a non-Indigenous chef, and then they go into a community that they're not from, and then they learn how to make something. And then they kind of come home and either make it their own or they remake that dish. So that's kind of the cookie cutter that was out there, and it was specifically what we didn't want to do. I know my traditional foods. I'm not learning, right? I have something to teach people, and that's what it was that I wanted to do. So the series is a docu-series. It's not a cooking show. I do cook in every episode, But that was something that made it a little different. We wanted to dive deeper into not just learning about these foods in certain areas, but what types of foods and contributions that we've had to the people around us, and how does it affect everyday people, right? So that was what we wanted to focus on, and just really celebrate foods and our foods in a way that hadn't really, we haven't seen it been done before.
Right. And cooking in front of a camera is not new to you. You have a YouTube channel where you're cooking up a storm in every single video there. What was it like for you to sort of transition from YouTube and having that sort of intimate relationship with your kitchen, yourself, your food, and one camera to, having sort of like a crew behind you filming One Dish, One Spoon?
That was definitely a transition in my career, but I think as chefs, like I've been cooking for 30 years this year, we're just natural teachers, right? We're used to explaining what we're doing to people because we're always showing people new things and what to do in the kitchen. So it was kind of a natural transition. My sister encouraged me to do a YouTube channel during COVID because there wasn't much going on. This was before I had Yuego, like my store. And so we started the YouTube channel, and right as soon as we were kind of like getting comfortable with that, this opportunity arose for me to open a restaurant. Then I kind of got busy and things went wild from there. With the YouTube channel though, like that's how Top Chef found me. That's how Milk Masters found me. That's how ABTN was interested in what it was I was doing, because they seen me doing something online and they're like, she's not just cooking. She's talking about the food, where it comes from, how it makes her feel, why is it good for our people, right? So it was all these things that I was kind of naturally doing without being without needing writers and being able to be fed lines and things like that. So I really thank Big Soul Productions. They were the ones that kind of, believed in me and approached us and was like, hey, we can get micro grants to do a pitch and like, I think you have something here. So it's really up to them, and that transition's been pretty good. It's a lot easier. It's just me and my sister doing my YouTube, and she would edit the videos for me. To now, it's just, kind of show up and do my thing. So it's a, even though it's way huger, it's a little less stressful.
Let's listen to a snippet from the first episode. Tanya, you're cooking with Chef Rick Paulus, a fellow Mohawk chef, and in here he's putting together a wild rice salad.
I'm going to start putting this rice salad itself together. I'm going to add some sunflower seeds, a bit of the dried cranberries, add some sweetness to the smokiness that we've got going on, some rose hip. It's got a really nice, fragrant atmosphere to it, so.
The sun chokes.
When we garnish this, we'll actually take the milkweed pods and we'll cut them in half, and we'll throw one right on top.
In that episode, you two made beaver meat tamales and venison sliders along with that wild rice salad. And it's what was behind sort of picking the foods behind this first episode and then in future episodes?
This was just what I had in my stock ready to go. So I said, I'm gonna grab all my indigenous stuff and throw it on the table. And I invited a chef over to cook, and we cooked. and then the other ones, it was kind of planned, so, I had to get that stuff ready. Like, that day, we didn't really know what we were doing, but we were doing it.
Right, and you worked a lot with your sister, Dakota, and she sort of became, like, the director and the writer. How did that all happen? I mean, it seems like the crew here is pretty small for the first season, at least.
Mm-hmm. Dakota's an amazing writer. She's a storyteller. She's incredibly talented. She holds a lot of knowledge for people in this area. And she's kind of a historian in her own right and genealogist. So on top of her being incredible, she's just herself. She was a very gifted writer. So it really naturally came to her because she's never ever worked on any type of film set before. So we had Jesse Anthony as like a director mentor for our first couple of episodes, and the production company like, they really know their stuff, right? So they were just right in there, like, this is what we need to do, or how do we do it? Like, even just getting used to, you know, saying cut, saying action, like, doing those types of things were all kind of new territory for us at the time. But yeah, Dakota just, you know, took to it like a duck in water, and she wrote these really incredible episodes, and she did it fast, right? So I think that made the journey fairly easy, because I think at the end of the day, she really had in her mind what it is that she wanted to cover, right? Like, what is it we're going to show? But we were going to do it through a food lens. So you'll see that throughout the season, she is in the season as well. And you'll see that she is a true gift to my family, and being able to show her knowledge, you know, especially with my mom not being around anymore, I really rely on her for a lot of my traditional knowledge and things that I want to pursue. She kind of already knows some things about, right? So she's definitely a good resource for me to have. And I think as a family, we've really grown to let each other's gifts speak for themselves.
All right. And what are some of the bigger topics that you guys cover in One Dish, One Spoon?
Each episode kind of has its own little challenge that we're talking about. So we have one about lied corn in our community and people not realizing kind of how close to the brink we are on losing this, and how there's really only 2 to 3 families spearheading commercial production in my community. The other thing we talk about, there's an episode called Water is Life. And we talk about water on Six Nations. And what I really love about that episode is how different it is. It wasn't just talking about we're poor, we have no water, and we've kind of heard that story a few times, right? So what we did was I go to the water house, I haul water with my dad for our well, and we go to the actual pump house, and we learn about where Six Nations sits in terms of their water treatment plant, and, you know, find out that we've already spent $40 million, but, you know, not even a third of our community is hooked up to the water line. So we see really big challenges like that. And then we also highlight some really good people doing water work in our community, Dr. Dawn Hill and her daughter, Makasha Looking Horse Henry. So they talk about how their family is spearheading water conservation efforts and spreading awareness to just how toxic our river was. And you find out that, you know, our river was so toxic at one point that the only other more toxic river in Canada caught on fire, right? So we have a huge journey to go. So that's something I was really proud of, to be able to show that. So yeah, each episode kind of does focus on a challenge that we have in Haudenosaunee communities and really highlight them. And what I love is highlighting them from people in this community. You're getting our humor. You're seeing how we talk and act every day, right? And we're doing it in our backyard, which I think is really incredible too, because you don't get to see that very often, especially not for more than one episode.
All right. We'll be back right after this break. This is The Menu on Native America Calling.
States are gaining ground and shutting down high-interest payday loan businesses on tribal land. The laws are intent on protecting consumers, especially low-income borrowers. But it also raises questions about how state laws could infringe on tribal sovereignty. We'll discuss the issue on the next Native America Calling.
Heshe! Elia nishi yam ketsa nishi ton ate atununa ton itse manna. Asna tonis ayo ya na kadiahnan tonis yamakwa bos awa shua tuta isto visit healthcare.gov/coverage kin awa nan ta tonis 1-800-318-2596 and penan akadawa. Lukia Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services ton apenan itu lokenawe. Elahkwa. Thank you.
listening to The Menu on Native America Calling, our feature on Indigenous food. I'm Andy Murphy, and we are just wrapping up with Tanya Brandt. She is a Mohawk Nation chef from the Six Nations, and I understand there is a second season on the way, Tanya. Can you tell me a little bit about what we expect to be seeing from you and your sister in the second season, and also, you know, knowing that somewhere in the middle of filming your mom had passed away, how does the second season sort of handle that big transition in you guys' lives?
Season two was a pretty incredible opportunity. We'd only submitted some rough cuts for about the first and second episode, and APTN really liked the direction that we were going in. So they offered us $1.4 million to do a second season that will be 13 episodes, and it will also all be dubbed in Mohawk. So you'll have a Mohawk language program as well that comes out of that series. They changed the genre, so the genre is more of a docu-soap where you're following me in my everyday life and what it is, and you actually really get to see what an Indigenous chef does, and I get to bring the cameras along for some really cool opportunities. And because it was a docu-soap and following my life, it was interesting process to writing episodes, because it's kind of a new genre still, right? So very reality-based, and, you know, losing my mother was definitely something that we didn't foresee coming. But I also felt, how can I not talk about it, right? Because she was such a big influence on my life, and more importantly, with this Indigenous food sovereignty movement and Haudenosaunee, just like seed keeping and knowledge, we lost so much with her, right? And I want to really do her justice and show people some of the incredible things that she did, and most importantly, raising my sisters and I, right? I think that was an incredible contribution she's given to Indian country, and I like to say that it was, you know, it's taking four of us to replace her. So you'll see that we're kind of doing the episodes right now. We did wrap our principal filming for the second season, and we're kind of, you know, going through the confessionals and all that kind of stuff now. So we are still working on that particular episode. I think it's going to be a bit of a heartbreaker for a lot of people to watch that episode, but I'm really excited for the season and what people can see, like, with a budget, right? The different kind of adventures we go on and how we're able to expand outside of Six Nations and be able to travel. We go back to the Mohawk Valley where our people came from, and so there's just a lot of incredible moments that I got to share with my sons and being able to bring them with us as well, so you get to see me as a mom, not just as a chef. So I'm really excited for season two, and hoping that will come out sometime next year, and hopefully released in the U.S. ASAP.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Tanya. You can follow One Dish, One Spoon on APTN, and follow Tanya Brandt and all of her food adventures on social media. We have links to everybody on our show website, NativeAmericaCalling.com. I want to move over to Zach Ducheneau in Washington, D.C. He is the former administrator of the USDA's Farm Service Agency, and he is Cheyenne River Sioux. Welcome back to The Menu, Zach.
It's good to be here, Andy.
All right. Just a bit ago, I mentioned that the Farm Service Agency takes care of a lot of farm finances. Just to give us an understanding of what the Farm Service Agency does, what does it do? What was your role as the administrator of the USDA's Farm Service Agency?
You bet, Andy. I'll give you the flyover view of the Farm Service Agency. It's one of the most farmer-facing or producer-facing or citizen-facing aspects of the United States Department of Agriculture, with offices in over 2,100 counties and around 11,000 staff members, providing 52 programs to over 3 million producers every year. And that's in addition to the farm loan programs and the ag finance work that's done there. Everything from conservation programs to emergency and disaster recovery programs, price support programs, and of course the farm loan programs, which were really a significant area of emphasis for us at the agency in the last 4 years.
All right. And as you step aside after 4 years as administrator, what stands out as something you're proud of?
One of the things that I'm most proud of is that we were able to make the case for a different way of doing business at the agency, and one that is more inclusive and works to push the boundaries of the programs out. Instead of using discretion to limit access, we really focused on how staff can use their discretion to get folks in the door and work more closely with producers in programs and in the farm loan programs as well, to ensure that those resources, those investments in rural America are getting out where they're intended in rural communities and to ag producers across the country.
Okay. How did your goals and priorities change from when you started to now, to this month when you left?
When I went in, I had a really conservative perspective on what we might be able to accomplish, understanding that we're going into a bureaucracy, an institution, and I'm not using bureaucracy in a derisive connotation. I believe in the value of a bureaucracy because it has its own inertia and its own processes, and it ensures some stability for people. You know, we see the tumultuous messaging that's coming out of the next administration. That's the inherent strength of a bureaucracy. Things are going to continue and it's going to alter course slightly. So as I came into the agency, I was really thoughtful about that and trying to understand how we could make the most impact. And it turns out the same things that we have known in Indian country since time immemorial, telling stories is the best way to help folks consider or reconsider a position or a frame of mind that they were in. So we brought producer stories to the table that aligned with the policy shifts that we wanted to make, shared those with our dedicated, devoted career staff, and it wasn't very long. They were coming up with ideas on how to promote that approach that's getting the programs out there to producers. So I had a very conservative perspective, but looking back on what we were able to accomplish in just 4 years using that approach, really proud of all of the work that we've got done. And I think it's making a difference in rural communities, in Indian country, ag operations, and even in some urban agriculture settings right now today as we have this conversation.
All right. I want to go back a little bit to the farm crisis of the 1980s. That was a big time in your life, and it showed you just a whole bunch about USDA and all of these different processes and programs that work for farmers and rural America. Can you tell us how that, you know, going through that farm crisis in the 80s influenced how you do work today and how you did work at the federal level?
Absolutely. As time passes, we gain perspective on things that we lived through. And growing up on the ranch, I was the third generation on the ranch. My father had bought the place from his grandfather, and they worked real hard to carve out an existence there where they could perhaps raise their families and be part of feeding and clothing their community and the country. Looking back on those times now, though, I see that we were actually really poor, and my folks were definitely very much up against it, if you will. And studying that, analyzing why that came to be, a lot of that really amounted to poor federal policy that didn't consider the end user or the end beneficiary of that policy. It was a decidedly different approach than this administration has taken or this iteration of the federal government. As an example, when we came in February of 2021, we saw that there was some distress in our portfolio, in our direct and guaranteed loan portfolio. Congress also acknowledged that and gave the administration the tools to help those distressed borrowers stay on the farm while we could do the work of adjusting policy to ensure that they can get better terms and better deals from the agency. Because of that, 43,000 producers received payments to help catch them up on delinquent debts. The approach that was taken in the 80s was exactly the opposite. The Reagan administration chose to take a look at the delinquency and chose to pull the rug out from under many of those producers who could still be viable today. And in fact, many of them are still viable today, despite that really poor exercise of federal policy and that misguided approach to promoting rural American economies.
All right, so when you're coming in, you have this focus on small farmers and rural agriculture. Did your time at as the administrator of the SFA, did your time and your work, benefit small farmers and rural agriculture? And what were some of the most beneficial things that had to change or that you implemented?
Coming into the administration, I had shared with them in my letter of interest that I thought the ag finance system was broken and needed some work. And if I could be part of helping to solve that, I would absolutely be interested in joining the administration. So ag finance was one of the main things that I wanted to address, gaining a better understanding of what the flexibility that the Farm Service Agency could leverage without statutory changes. And then we went to work codifying that in a regulatory process so that our staff in the countryside would know that they're supported in using their discretion in a little different and better way. If you will ask producers in the last 40 years, what are the three main reasons that you wouldn't want to have an FSA loan, the first thing they would say is the FSA takes too much collateral. We had been using a misguided interpretation of up to 150% security position, which resulted in us taking 200, 300, 400% security in a loan. So what that means is if we have a $100,000 loan out there with that producer, $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 of their assets could be tied up with that loan, and that limits their ability to leverage those assets to their benefit or sell those assets when the time is right without going through the process of getting that approved with their local Farm Service Agency loan officer. We changed that rule, so now it is not more than 125%, and that change is based on volumes of data that we engaged in studying to find out how much do we actually need in security to protect the taxpayers' investment in this operation. 125% gives the agency plenty of cushion with respect to that security margin so that they're able to fully collect on behalf of the taxpayer in the event things don't go as planned. Another of the big changes is producers will tell you that the FSA doesn't give me the terms I need to actually make money. They give me just the terms I need to be able to grind this out and force me to have an off-farm income. So we've given our staff in the countryside flexibility to offer better terms to producers at the beginning of the relationship instead of waiting until things may go bad and then we need to work things out. The premise is that producers that have more access to their production income are going to be better participants in the rural economy, and they're going to be better positioned to take advantage of opportunity when it presents itself. And then the last highlight of that rule change is that we created a distressed borrower set-aside program for producers that were on our books as of September 25th, 2024. It's a low-doc version of a payment set-aside that accrues an interest at a lower rate so that producers, if they have a bad year, can just move that payment to the back end of the note and get back to the work of producing in that next year in a more timely manner.
All right. So you spent a number of years at the head of the Intertribal Agriculture Council and worked a lot with Tribal Ag. How did that experience working with Tribal Ag inform how you worked with tribes on that federal level as the administrator?
We did a lot of work with tribes on the federal level and tried to emphasize that nation-to-nation relationship that Native Americans and their tribal governments have come to expect. We entered into several groundbreaking conservation agreements that would allow for the entirety of some of our tribal nations in the Great Plains to be enrolled in conservation programs. We struggled to overcome the distrust of the federal government by Indian country, but that didn't stop us from reaching out and getting these agreements signed and provided that technical assistance to tribes so that they still have a window of opportunity to participate in those conservation programs as more acres become available. We also work directly with tribal producers throughout our time in the last 4 years to ensure that the products that they're growing, which are generally predominantly livestock and livestock products, have a more viable and valuable safety net to help them when things go wrong. So we've made a lot of adjustments to what's known as the supplemental disaster assistance programs that many of our Native American producers really need when they have a blizzard, when they have a fire that rolls through, any of the other natural disasters that trigger those programs.
Okay.
But really made a conscious effort to use what we learned while I was at the Intertribal Ag Council and make sure that the programmatic changes we are engaging in here at the national level reach out to all of those producers that may be underserved in the past.
All right. Well, now that you are not the administrator anymore, where will you use your expertise and influence going forward? We have about 30 seconds before the break.
Well, I'm looking forward to spending a lot more time out in the countryside and spending some time back on the ranch, reconnecting with the way of life that kind of got me here, but also looking for some work to do in finance and have some really definitive ideas about how we can improve ag finance for everybody in the country while making profit for everybody in the value chain.
All right, that was Zach Ducheneau. He's the former administrator of the USDA's Farm Service Agency. We're going to be back after this break, but you can join us by calling 1-800-996-2848. Tell us about some of the new and exciting food initiatives happening in your area. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE.
MFA programs at the Institute of American Indian Arts, IAIA, honor your voice and vision. IAIA is a tribal university whose low residency programs empower artists, writers, and community leaders through innovation and indigenous-centered education. Whether your path is creative writing, studio arts, or cultural administration, IAIA fosters respect, dialogue, and community. Applications accepted through February 15th at iaia.edu, who support this show. The Alaska Native Art Auction Gala is March 21st, 2025 in Anchorage, Alaska. Please consider donating art and help Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation raise needed funds. Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation's mission is to be the leader in bringing Native voices to Alaska and the nation. With your support, we're able to produce such programs as National Native News, Native America Calling, and more. Donor forms and more information about the auction can be found at knba.org. Anyone who donates art before February 14th will be automatically entered into a drawing to win $500. Program support by AmeriCorps Vista, where you can kickstart your career and help others in your community. With AmeriCorps Vista, you can serve in an office setting and address issues of poverty while gaining career experience and building your leadership skills. Learn more by visiting AmeriCorps.gov/Vista today. That's AmeriCorps.gov/Vista.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
When you file online for your PFD, every Alaskan can support great causes like National Native News. Just select KNBA-FM Kawanak Broadcast Corporation. With your support, you can help us make a difference in our community.
You're listening to The Menu on Native America Calling, our special feature on Indigenous food. I'm Andy Murphy. Up next in a couple of minutes, we'll be talking with Mariah Gladstone about her new cookbook for kids called Mountains to Oceans. You can join us by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE. Tell us why it's important that you get your kids in the kitchen. I want to go to our caller on the line. We have Chinupa over in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, listening to Keeley. Hey, Chinupa, go ahead.
Hey, thank you guys for coming in, and Sean and all of them guys listening. That brother that came to South Dakota one time, and we had a understanding about our food. And so we have a corn chowder, okay, with buffalo chunks in it. And so when you come down to the reservation, have one. Have a good chub and a big piece of fried bread. That's what comes with that. Well, we also have this one they call the Big Indian. It's a buffalo hamburger set. Man, these are beautiful things in our way of doing things long time ago. But so we put this in our show, and so our people can use it. Like they say, we chokakile na haksti, wanapikile na yankinkste. So it will help our people, even our elders. And Cora Hildebrandt, Cora Whitehorse, she's been always helping us with us on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. So we'll open a tucker to all of you. And take that fried bread and the soup. Oh, man, enjoy it, people. Enjoy it. We'll open up. Thank you. Ahoo.
All right. Thank you so much for that, Chinupa. Yeah, those food stands out in the res. That's part of the heart of Indigenous food in Native America, too. Before we move on to Mariah, I want to go back to Zach Ducheneau for one quick question here. Going forward. Okay, we don't have Zach anymore. Sorry about that. Let's go on to Mariah. Mariah Gladstone is the CEO of IndigiKitchen. She's joining us from Babb, Montana. She's Blackfeet and Cherokee. Welcome back to The Menu, Mariah.
Hi, it's so good to be here.
Thank you for joining again. So your new cookbook, Mountains to Oceans, Kids Recipes from Native Land. Why focus on kids in your first cookbook?
You know, I think that it's so important that kids get empowered in the kitchen and really learn how to work with ingredients and have a vested interest in their food, but also all of the other skills that it teaches. The working with fractions, the hands-on skills, just learning how to navigate things like knives and hard things, but also just being able to have that sense of ownership over their own food and take care of their bodies. And of course, work together in another environment with parents or with siblings, and to really be able to create things. And I think the kitchen is one of the best spaces for kids to be able to do that. So I wanted to create a resource that made things really achievable for young Native chefs.
All right. Did you have a resource like this when you were a kid?
You know, I had a couple of cookbooks that were geared specifically for kids. I still have them. So there are still things that I reference back to, but I was really lucky. And some folks have heard me talk about this, is my mom took an early childhood education class that said that kids that grow up cooking learn fractions better. So I was always having to double recipes or have them or all sorts of crazy things that my mom would dream up. And it made me feel really comfortable in the kitchen, but also built a whole bunch of other skills as well.
All right. So each recipe, in the cookbook is it geared towards maybe a child of a certain age, or what are some things that maybe parents should know before getting into your cookbook and maybe other cookbooks geared towards kids?
Yeah, I think that kids' cookbooks tend to break things down into what's achievable for kids. And of course, everyone knows their own child the best. I just got off a call with some folks at an immersion school, and they said that they have kids at their school as young as preschool that are more than competent handling knives and butchering buffalo. So if that is what that kid is able to do, then it's up to the adults to make sure that they're working to their level. I tried to put some basic guidelines into the book, some steps that younger kids might feel more comfortable doing, whereas, you know, if there's a component that involves more of a cooking, like flipping pancakes or something that requires a little bit more dexterity, navigating a hot pan, so it might be something better suited to an older kid or an adult. So I tried to put some of that stuff into the book and make it something that there were steps that kids of any age would be able to achieve, but also that will grow with the kid. So as the kid ages, more things will be accessible, and it will, of course, be a resource for adults, whether parents or just adults that want a fun cookbook to use as well.
What are some of your favorite recipes in the cookbook? I see we got them. Looks like there's a couple dozen in here, and they're separated by like breakfast, lunch and dinner, soup, snacks, sauces, beverages, desserts. What are a couple of your favorite recipes?
You know, I love the recipe for sunflower butter caramel popcorn because it's so easy to make this really fun sweet snack, but it's also something that kids can work with. I just got feedback from one of the folks that got an early version of the cookbook, and her and her five-year-old made this recipe together, and they had a great time making it together. And then, of course, she said, teeth brushing time now. So I love that recipe. It's such a good snack. But then, of course, I think that I have a recipe for cream cheese in the sauce. In the sauces section, and it's actually made with sunflower seeds. So it's a totally dairy-free cream cheese, and you can use it in a whole bunch of different ways, but it also just shows the broad diversity of what native foods can be. And we can make these cool sauces and spreads just using our traditional ingredients. And then I think one of my favorites is also I made roll-ups with bell peppers and steak strips, and it's kind of wrapping up bell peppers and onions in little smashed steak strips. And of course, there's a whole bunch of fun rolling activities, and you get to make a marinade and all that kind of stuff, but they're so delicious, but also they're colorful and they're bright and they're fun, and they're utilizing, you know, these native foods that we have in a different variety. You know, depending on where you are, you may have different resources in terms of wild game access, whether it's buffalo or elk or deer. But there are things that you can grow, there are things that you can harvest or get from a local farmer. And it's a really fun way of making kids eat steak and vegetables. So I love that recipe as well.
Yeah, you work a lot with in front of audiences. You talk, you cook for a lot of different people, and including kids. When you're cooking with kids and working with kids, how do you see their attitude change when they're in the kitchen? How do you see like their perspective changing when they're cooking with Indigenous foods?
You know, I think that kids get a reputation for being super picky or not willing to try new things. But I've noticed that that changes almost immediately when the kids are making something themselves. And so I work with a lot of schools and classrooms, and if you have kids do any part of a recipe, they're immediately more willing to taste it. And because they made it, they want to like it. And so I've noticed that that's a great way of, you know, you're exercising. It's kind of like a craft. Kids love crafts. Most adults love crafts too. But it's a way of kind of exercising that creative part of your brain. And then you get a chance to try these new things. You get to learn where they come from. So immediately kids are way more willing to try those. And then hopefully they become part of your meal planning and the things that you incorporate into your recipes at home.
All right. What was your process for putting all of these recipes together? It's I've talked to several cookbook authors about this process, and it's always different, but it's always such a huge months and years long process to put all of these recipes that you might have made for, you know, for years, and then all of a sudden having to write it down is like such a different process for some folks. Tell us about what it was like for you to pin all of these down and make sure that it is correct and ready for the printers.
Yeah, it was definitely a process of looking at the things that I wanted to be able to showcase for kids, you know, how to make wild game really accessible, and also how to make recipes that kids will already recognize as food. So, you know, there's a recipe for a pumpkin seed pizza crust using pumpkin seed flour and chia seeds, and, you know, it's pizza. There is a dairy cheese on it in the way that I made it, but it's something that kids are already seeing as food, and by changing up the way the crust is made, it can be way more achievable. But also, that recipe took a lot of troubleshooting. Pizza should be handheld. You should be able to hold it and bite into it without relying on forks and knives and utensils. That's part of the fun of pizza. And so to make something like that without gluten and using indigenous ingredients takes a little bit of troubleshooting. And then it has to be kid-friendly. So there was a lot of process of, you know, sending out the recipes to folks with kids, having them try it. I dropped off different recipe tests with neighbors and friends. I'm like, try this. Tell me what your kids think. I need brutal honesty. And so there was a lot of workshopping that relied on more than just my own judgment of what's yummy or fun or achievable. There was kids involved in the process, because I think that that's a pretty important part of making a kid's cookbook.
Right. And have items on here like indigenous Snickers and cake and tea and nuggets and tacos. You know, a lot of these things, like you said, are already recognizable to children. I want to talk about a little bit about the cover of the cookbook. Tell me about that, and tell me about the artist Rudy Blackplume.
Yeah, Rudy is a phenomenal graphic artist. She's Kainai from the Blood Reserve. She lives just across the border from me, up in Lethbridge, Alberta. And she's a teacher, but she does a lot of art. I love her style because it's so bright and colorful. And I talked to her about designing the cover of this book. And we sat down and we workshopped what I wanted to see. And I said, I really want characters doing something, you know, but not just cooking, really connecting to the landscape. And I love the image that she came up with for the cover. It's an image of Chief Mountain, which is actually our most sacred mountain to the Blackfeet people. I can view it from my living room window, but it's also a place that, you know, it's so recognizable. And because it's a mountain, you know, I wanted something that was going to incorporate mountains to oceans, which is basically my way of saying from the center of the continent to the coast, we want to incorporate ingredients from all across Turtle Island. And so the image also shows a mother and child picking berries together, which I think is so much what this is about. It's about doing things together on the land, gathering food, harvesting it, and then turning it into recipes in the kitchen together with family, and to support healthy recipes for our bodies, but also for the land. And that's really what I wanted this to be.
All right. For folks who maybe just like to learn from the pages of a cookbook, who maybe not necessarily have kids and are planning to cook every recipe here, what else are folks learning about Indigenous food? And what are they learning about you, too, when folks just go through this cookbook and read about these ingredients and sort of imagine what's happening in a kitchen?
I think that this cookbook really represents a lot of the work that I do with IndigiKitchen. Our cultures are not stagnant. They have evolved over time. And I think that this is a great representation of the modernity of Indigenous cuisine, the ways in which we can connect with our ancestral foods, our traditional wisdom in the modern kitchen in ways that are fun and we can work with when we get home from work at the end of the day. And so I want to showcase recipes, like blue corn turkey nuggets that are super friendly to kids, but are also delicious high protein snacks that anyone can eat and enjoy. And I think that that really comes through on these pages and in the recipes that are showcased.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for our conversation today. You can find more information about Mariah Gladstone, IndigiKitchen, and her cookbook, Mountains to Oceans, on our website, NativeAmericaCalling.com, also by just looking up IndigiKitchen. I want to say thank you to our guests today. We just heard from Mariah Gladstone, Tanya Brandt, and Zach Ducheneau. I'm Andy Murphy, and this is The Menu on Native America Calling. We'll see you next time.
See Renewal's expertise in energy, housing, land use, fire protection, and more in multi-jurisdictional environments helps tribes leverage existing assets, grow capacity, and gain competitive advantage. See Renewal supports this show. SEERenewal.com. Support for journalism that raises the awareness of child well-being to citizens and to policymakers provided by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, building a brighter future for children, families, and communities. Information at aecf.org. Repatriation is the return of ancestors and stolen culture. The Association on American Indian Affairs and the Tunica Biloxi Tribe will host the 10th Annual Repatriation Conference February 25th, 26th, and 27th, 2025 in Marksville, Louisiana. The conference will provide expert hands-on training about domestic and international repatriation. Registration and more information available at Indian-Affairs.org. The Association on American Indian Affairs supports this show.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
roll on. Come on, you lazy steamer, move on. Clear the river, here we come. Watch her smoke, boy.